We are on Das Vafhemud base, and we are in the medium width line, sort of not quite halfway down, not by the two dots, but a little bit before. I had left one last topic in this part about Erva here to discuss, because it really raises some more profound questions. And the Gemara says the following. We had just said that Erva Vashoshis was when a few lines ago, that if you see someone's private, anything that's considered Erva, it could be private parts, it could be with someone else, whatever would be considered Erva. If you see that through a looking glass, then you're not allowed to daven. As opposed to Tsoa, if it's excrement, so once you have a barrier, it doesn't matter that you can actually see it through the glass. But then the Gemara says, Amar Rav Yehuda, the word ends with Akum Orum. Akum is the last word on the line. It's about 12, 13, 14 lines from where they get the medium width. I think it's the 12th line. So Amar Rav Yehuda, Akum Orum, Asa Likros Kriya Shema Kenego. If you have a non-Jew, not wearing clothing, and you know, you're seeing them or you're facing them when it comes time to daven, so you're not allowed to read Kriya Shema. So the Gemara says immediately, my area Akum. Why does Rabbi Yehuda tell us Akum, a non-Jew, Afili Yisrael Nani? It makes it sound like a non-Jew, you know, daven. If it's a Jew there, then it's okay. So Yisrael Pshita, so the Gemara says, why do you have to tell us that? So the Gemara says, Yisrael Pshita Leid Asr. It was obvious that by a Jew, it would be Asr. Ela Akum Itzrichale. He had to tell us about an Akum. Mahu de Tema Hoaluk Sibuhu. Asher bisar chamorim bisaram. You would have said that since it says that the Nabi, I think Yecheskel, says, speaking about the Egyptians, that asher bisar chamorim bisaram, their meat, their flesh is like the flesh of donkeys, and then it says zirmas susim zirmasam. It's not clear what zirma means, but it might seem to mean their seed, is like the seed of horses. So ema kachorma baramahu. I would have thought that there's no problem. It's not considered Erva. It's like if you see an animal not wearing clothing, so then there's no problem reading Kriya Shema, even if you see an animal's private parts. So you would have thought the same thing. Kamash v'lan, d'in hu nami ikru Erva, d'chsev revas avihem al ro. That's why Rehud has to tell us that it applies to non-Jews, that their nakedness is considered Erva as well. Now, the truth is, to learn this Gemara without at least commenting, that it is a little bit jarring. It is a little bit jarring. It is a pasuk in Yechezkel, but Yechezkel is speaking poetically, denigrating the enemy. And here the Gemara seems to be taking this in a slightly more literal, legalistic fashion. The Gemara doesn't conclude this way. The Gemara says it's not true. It assumes that non-Jews have Erva in the same way that Jews have. But it's kind of interesting, interesting and it's jarring that the Gemara at least has a havamina. The Gemara suggests there is a havamina, the possible consideration to take this literally. It's odd in our context in particular, because the reason why Erva is an issue fundamentally, not only, but fundamentally, is because it's goreim hirhurim, right? If I see someone not covered appropriately, it's distracting. So that would be no different. It doesn't make a difference. It's not like when you see a non-Jew unclothed or a Jew unclothed that you can generally, I mean, if it's a question of circumcision, you might be able to tell the difference. But outside of that, it's not like you can tell the difference that one is Jewish and one is not Jewish. So why should that matter? Now, it only matters potentially, you might argue for oneself, but this is not a Gemara, the din is not being addressed to non-Jews. It's not if a non-Jew, if he's not wearing any clothing, he's not allowed to read Kriya Shema Daven. So it is kind of odd to have this kind of havamina, and it is a little bit jarring. It is a little bit jarring, the idea that you're going to quite literally compare a non-Jew to you have a havamina. We don't, but you would have thought that you would treat in this halachic context a non-Jew like the donkey rather than like a Jew. Now, the truth is, and I don't know how quite to read this, we do have in halacha a couple of contexts in which this comparison is taken a little more literally. I don't think that it's meant in the literal sense, but I think it's worth commenting on in two particular contexts. One is rather interesting. The first is that the Gemara assumes that if you, a Jewish person, is involved in an act of kiddushin. With a non-Jew, it's not kiddushin, and no get, no divorce is required to dissolve this kiddushin. What is the source for that? So the source, the Gemara in Kiddushin at the end of the third parak, quote, again, it wouldn't seem to be a real drasha, and maybe it's not really the source, but quoting from the Akedah, Shvulachem po im hachamor, Avram tells his two young people that he brought with him to remain here with the donkey, but the Gemara reads it as not im, but am hadom alachamor. And just as there's no kiddushin with an animal, there's no kiddushin with a non-Jew. That certainly doesn't need to rely upon, there are many other good reasons one could argue that kiddushin don't bind, but that is actually how the Gemara does learn it. The second context, which is a much more interesting one, was a shaila that Rabbeinu Tam, was approached with. This goes, and for any of you who might have happened to have learned the first chapter of Ksubos, and you probably have encountered this. You may encounter it a little bit elsewhere also. The Gemara there has a suggestion. I don't know if this was ever actually real, but the Gemara talks about what's called, I think, primus noctus, the right of the first night. I'm not sure such a thing actually ever existed historically, but the claim of the nobleman that he had the right to sleep with the bride before anybody else. So the Gemara does seem to describe such a thing happening, the hegemon, in the Gemara in Ksubas, I think, Daf Gimel, Daf Dalet Amud Beis. The Gemara talks about this hegemon, and it's trying to explain certain halachic aspects of when they would perform the chuppah. And the Gemara has the Gemara says that they were concerned about Jewish women being placed in this context, for whatever reasons. And in that discussion, the Gemara says, V'lidro shluhu da'ones shari. Why don't you tell them that if they're being forced to do it, they're not violating anything? In other words, the Gemara was afraid that the women who were tsnuot would get themselves killed rather than let the hegemon claim his right. So the Gemara says, teach them that ones is permitted. So everybody jumps up and asks the question, well, what do you mean? We know that gilei arayos, incest, adultery, and related prohibitions, you have to give up your life for. So why is it that ones is shari? What do you mean? You're telling them it's not permitted. It's in that context that Tosfos gives a somewhat famous answer, very much relevant in some context, halacha l'maisa, believe it or not, that karka olam is different. That when we say that a person has to give up his or her life in order to not violate idolatry, adultery, incest, and murder, it's only if you are if you are doing it actively. But if you are passive, if you are the Gemara, the Tosfos borrows a term from a parallel sugya talking about Esther Hamalka, that karka olam, if you are totally passive, so then it's not yeher gayavar, you're not doing anything. So a man who definitionally is doing something in basically every context where we'd be having sex, if he were threatened that he had to violate gilei arayos, he has to give up his life rather than violate gevera. But a woman, because she's passive in this context, would not have to do so. So that's why it's a very famous Tosfos. But Rabbeinu Tam, before Tosfos gets there, Rabbeinu Tam came up with a totally different answer. Rabbeinu Tam said that when it comes to a non-Jew, there's no non-Jewish man, presumably forcing a married Jewish woman to have a sexual relationship with him. So Rabbeinu Tam said that that's no different than bias behema. If a man puts a gun, if they put a gun to a person's head and say, have engaged in an act of bestiality, so that's not called gilei arayos. Even though it's a sexual act, which is in the parsha of arayos, behema is not considered arayos. It's a prohibition. It's a prohibition like lots of other prohibitions, but you don't have to give up your life in order to avoid violating that. So Rabbeinu Tam suggests that bias nachri ki bias behema, and therefore, there is no din of yeher gayavar. Rabbeinu Tam's position is very, very problematic. There are a lot of Gemara Tosfos points that are against Rabbeinu Tam's position, and that assume that sexual intercourse with a non-Jew, let's say for a married Jewish woman, is no different in terms of Yehari Galyavar, is not any less of Gilei Arayos than would be with a Jewish man. It's not any different. Why did Rabbeinu Tam want to say this? Rabbeinu Tam, this is where it's more, this is the historical footnote that's particularly fascinating. Rabbeinu Tam, he's obviously interpreting the Gemara on some level. Rabbeinu Tam had a case in front of him. The case was a non-Jewish woman who was married, shmadded, she apostatized. And she took up with this non-Jewish man, this Christian man. And now they wanted to, I presume the husband gave her a get at some point. And now she wanted to do a shma.
You mean a Jewish woman?
Then I'm sorry.
A non-Jewish woman.
I'm sorry. I apologize. Start again. Now, okay, thank you. Everybody who's going to let me go. A Jewish woman, it's hard for, from our vantage point, for a non-Jewish woman to apostatize. That's true. But a Jewish woman had an affair or apostatized, I don't know what the order was, and married this Christian man. The husband, let's say, presumably divorced, the Jewish husband. And now she wanted to do tshuva, and he was going to convert. He was going to convert this fellow. And they wanted to stay married. Now, the problem is that if there is a halacha in the Gemara Mishnah and Sota that if a married woman has an affair, she is not allowed, her husband has to divorce her, and she may not marry her paramour either. So the question is, how is she supposed to marry this guy if in fact he was, the Gemara has the term, Echad leba'al v'echad leboel. Both the husband and the paramour are not allowed to marry her, remain married to her. So Rabbeinu Tam said, it's not true. It's not true here because it doesn't apply by a guy. She's not asur lebaila. In other words, because it's like a bias behema, it's like she had intercourse with an animal, and that does not make her prohibited to her husband. It's not yehurig v'al yavor. You don't have to give up your life for that. Therefore, she's not prohibited to her husband on the basis of that. She's also not prohibited to the paramour. So now that the husband is divorced, she can, and this non-Jew converts, she can marry him. So most, all the Rishonim disagree with Rabbeinu Tam. They said it's against many Gemaras. It's very clear that a Jewish woman who has an affair with a non-Jewish man is asur labayla. She is now prohibited to remain with her husband. And by that logic, she should not be allowed to marry this man either. But that was Rabbeinu Tam's approach to dealing with this particular case. I imagine, I don't know that we have very much information about this, but some of this Rabbeinu Tam wanted to find a leniency because what we would call takanas hashavim. You wanted to leave the door open for her to do tshuva, to I don't want to say reconvert, but to return to Judaism. And in order to do so, Rabbeinu Tam did not want to ban her from remaining married to this husband. As I said, almost all the Rishonim disagree with Rabbeinu Tam on this particular issue on the halacha. However, there are a couple of other approaches that were used to deal with, that were suggested, I don't want to say used, but suggested to deal with this situation theoretically. I'll mention two of them. One of them, I don't remember who says, when I looked quickly, I didn't find it. But one of them is that it's true that when a Jewish woman would have an affair with a non-Jewish man, she would be prohibited to her husband, and by that token, prohibited to the paramour. Except for that when this non-Jew converts, we have a principle that Gershin is Gayer, Kikaton Shinolat Dummy. When a non-Jew converts, it's like the expression born again that is used by our Christians. That's our expression. A Gershin is Gayer, Kikaton Shinolat Dummy. He's born again. So he's like a new person. So for halachic purposes, when a non-Jew converts, he's not technically related to his parents, his sibling, anyone he was related to, legally speaking, before, even from a Jewish perspective. But some of the Rishonim suggested in this context as well. She had an affair with John, but now she's marrying Yochanan. They're two different people because a Gershin is Gayer, a non-Jew who converts, is Kekasin Shaldam. He's a new person. The Rush in Ksubas has a different, very sharp suggestion on this particular issue, and he says the following. He said that she should be allowed to marry this Jewish man, this non-Jewish man who had just converted, because the only time a woman is not allowed to marry her paramour is when she was permitted to him before. In other words, echad lebaal, the echad leboel. She was permitted to her husband. She becomes asa to her husband now. She would have been permitted in theory if the husband had divorced her or died to marry this other guy, Reuven, but now she becomes prohibited to him as well. But the Rush says the guy who was non-Jewish, she was already prohibited to anyway before she had this affair with him. And therefore, the issur of echad lebaal, the echad lebaal, doesn't apply in this context. It only applies in the context of someone who otherwise, in theory, she would have been permitted to marry, let's say if her husband divorced her, and now, because he had an affair with her, he's never allowed to marry her. But the non-Jew, at the time he had the affair, could have married her anyway, and therefore the technical parameters of Echad Labal and Echad Laboel do not apply. So, and that's how the other approaches that we've shown to dealing with the specific case, but Rabbeinu Tam took that quite literally. The expression is Bias Nachri Kabias Ba'ima. It is, and it should be a little jarring from our perspective. It is what it is. In the context of our Gemara, the Gemara says that that approach is incorrect in this context, that the erva of a goy is like the erva of a Jew for all of these purposes. Okay. So now the Gemara moves on. We're at the two dots. The Gemara says, "V'lo yis." The Mishnah has said, "V'lo yis kasa lo b'mayim haroyim, v'lo b'mei hamishra." So this is the original case in the Mishnah. You're reading, Zman Kriya Shema comes, you're in the water. If you can cover yourself in the water and read Kriya Shema, that's great. But you're not allowed to cover yourself in Mayim Rayim and not Mei Mishra. Mayim Rayim presumably means not cloudy water, but water that's dirty in some way, probably has a bad smell, just like Mei Mishra. Mei Mishra is the water in which you're soaking flax, which was pretty awful. So the Mishnah then said, the Mishnah continued, said, you're not allowed to cover yourself in those types of water. So imagine you're in a pool of Mei Mishra, of flax water. Don't ask me what you're doing there. I have no idea. Maybe I still have no clue. You can't cover yourself in that. Until you add some water to it, presumably to dilute it. But here's the catch. Imagine that you're sitting in this pool, even a bathtub full of Mei Mishra. You're going to put some water in there? How much water are you going to have to put in there in order to remove the stench? Like, you're going to need bathtubs and bathtubs of water. So why does the Mishra say, Ashiyata lo sochamayim? You put some water in there. What difference is it going to make? So the Gemara asks immediately, the Gemara says, V'kama maya rami v'ozil? How much water are you going to throw in there and keep throwing in? You're going to need, a whole truck full of water in order to dilute this so that it won't smell bad. So the Gemara says, now, Elahachi Ka'amar. The Mishnah has a lacuna in it. It has a something that's missing. Lo yiskasa lo b'mayim harayim v'lo b'mei hamishra klal. You can't, if it's a pool of flax water or otherwise filthy water, you can't use that. You can't.
Rabbi, where are we exactly on heaven?
We're at the two dots, in the middle of the medium width lines of Chafema base. After that.
Thank you.
So the Gemara says, you can't cover yourself in these two kinds of water because you can't. It's going to be filthy. And then Umei Raglayim, supposing standing next to you, sitting next to you, pool next to you, someone urinated. So there's a small puddle of urine there. So there, Ashiyata L'socha Mayim B'yikra. That is, you add some water to dilute it, so then it's permitted. And here the Gemara is going to have a fascinating machlokas. It really almost belongs to the world of Yoridea. The Gemara says, Tanu Rabbanan, Kamo Yatil L'socha Mayim. How much water do you have to put in? Now imagine, you're going to have to imagine for the moment, I think the Rambam even says this, that someone urinated once. So whatever amount that typically a person would leave, is what's there. So the Braisa says, how much do you have to put in? Kol shehu. Rab Zakai Omer Revius. You need a Revius. Okay, Revius Halog, let's say about 3 ounces. So that's Rab Zakai's, that's the Machlokas. So what is the dispute here? So Amar Rav Nachman says, Machlokes lebesof, ava betchila kol shehem. So what does this mean? It means that basof means there's already someone urinated, there's a little bit of urine there. So the machlokes of whether or not you need to add a revius, or it's enough to add just a little bit of kol shehu of water, that's only if someone urinated already. The urine's there already is the better way of putting it. But if you want to put water there before someone urinates, then everybody agrees kol shehu is sufficient. Why is that? What's the difference between the two? So the truth is, it's bizarre in our context. Who cares? If the issue is it smells bad, or it could give off a smell, So I'd imagine that it shouldn't make a difference which came first. But apparently, at least according to this opinion, maybe everybody agrees, I'm not sure.
Can you please mute? Can you mute whoever's talking? There's a bunch of stuff going on.
The issue is not simply a question of proportions, but it's an issue of bittul. So we learned in the fifth parak of Avodah Zarah, I know it's been a few years now, from 2-3 years, we learned this discussion. Supposing I have water sitting here, water that's kosher, and I have wine, I have yayin nesach, that's dripping in drop by drop. Now, when the first drop falls in, it's batel b'shishim, not a problem. What if another drop falls in, and another drop falls in, and another drop falls in? Do we say, ad infinitum, kama, kama, batel? If every drop falls in, it now becomes batel. And it doesn't matter. But let's say we had an ounce of water to start with. By now, 10 ounces of wine have fallen in here. But because it fell in drop by drop, it's all water as far as we're concerned. So this is a major machlokes for Rishonim, the Ravid and most other Rishonim, how to paskin like in Yerodea. And in general, practices of Issa Beheta. But it seems here that the Gemara is employing that principle as well, which is the opinion that says that Kol Shehu is okay in whatever context believes, comma, comma, batel. That's the way Rashi explains it. I haven't seen any other Rishonim disagree with this. Now, that's the opinion. That is the opinion of Kol Shehu. So according to Rav Nachman, both Tanoim agree. They both agree that there is bittul of comma, comma, as long as you put the water there first, and then someone is, and the urine is dripping in, somehow that would be okay. The Machlokas says only if the urine is there first and you're adding water. Now, in that case, it's kind of hard to, it's really about this kind of a bittul, it's kind of hard to understand why Kol Shehu is sufficient. Revius, I understand. If you presume, especially like the Rambam, that that doesn't mean if I have a pool of urine that a Revius of water is enough. It means if I have a small amount, let's say, you know, someday a person would produce in one session. So then it's hard to understand why Kol Shehu, anybody should say that a Kol Shehu works. And I understand why everybody agrees that a Kol Shehu works, the tiniest amount, if it's there first, because comma, comma, batil, each drop that falls in becomes batil. It's hard to understand the other way. Rav Yosef presents it differently. Rav Yosef on the machlokas l'chatchila. Rav Yosef says, no, the machlokas of whether or not you need a revius mayim is when you put the water or Kol Shehu is sufficient, is only if you put the water there first. The opinion that says you only need one drop of Kol Shehu believes, obviously, comma, comma, batel. And the opinion that says that Revius obviously would say, we're not going to say comma, comma, batel here because the urine clearly overwhelms the water. Maybe because this is an issue not of Isser Beheter and Bittel, but it's an issue of, like, is the urine really there or not? But everybody agrees, Ava Lebesov, Rav Yosef says, Divrei HaKol Revius. Everybody would agree that you need a revius to dilute it. The question, of course, is why? Now, we still go back to that question. And I haven't seen any of the Rishonim really explain. If you believe, as the Rambam does, and I have no idea what the average amount of urine a person would produce on one shot is, but if you believe, like the Rambam, that the more that's there, the more that you need, that revius is only enough for kind of the minimum, for sort of a single session, so presumably it has something to do with diluting, really actually and physically diluting the effect of the urine. The only other possibility, but it still doesn't really seem to work so well, is Revius is actually a very important minimum shear, but it's not really well known. I know that most of us think that the minimum shear for a mikveh, for a ritual bath in which to immerse oneself, is 40 sa'ah. You know, I don't know how much 40 sa'ah is, but it's supposed to be... It is the volume of 3 cubic amos. So, you can figure out exactly what that is and exactly how many cubic feet. That is what the minimum shear of a mikveh is. That minimum shear for a mikveh is only for a person. If you are talking about let's say I have a kli, a vessel, which I wish to immerse. Now today we don't do that anymore. I mean, we do tfilas kalim, but not for some of atara purposes, not for ritual impurity purposes. When we buy new kalim owned by a non-Jew, metal kalim, glass kalim, so we do tefillah. I'm going to put that aside for the moment. That's more complicated. But if you're talking about once upon a time, when we were careful about Tumah v'Tahara, when a vessel became tummy because it came in contact with a dead rodent or something like that. So then in that context, Midda Oraisa, you only require, if you can physically immerse the vessel, let's say it's a needle, let's say it's a sewing needle and it's metal, so it's Mekabel Tumah, susceptible to ritual impurity. If you have a revius of water in the ground, you can put Minat Torah, you can put your sewing needle there and you're good. At some point, the Chachamim did away with this. They were mevatel the revius of mikvah, and they required 40 sa'ah for everything. But in theory, revius is a mikvah. Now, it makes more sense, by the way, if the revius is there first, and then the urine goes in. So you could say that somehow the mikvah changes the status of the meiraglayim. It would have been nice if some of the Rishonim said something here. And again, I think for the Rambam, that's certainly not the case, because he sees this as really a volume question and just a physical dilution. But that's what the Gemara says. There are two opinions. There's a machlokas atanayim, whether the shear required for meiraglayim to do away with the problem of reading Kriya Shema in the presence of meiraglayim is a tiny amount of water, or at least a revius, let's say three, four ounces of water. And then this is machlokas hamarayim. When does that machlokas apply? Does it apply specifically when the urine is there first and you're putting the water in? But if the water was there first, everybody agrees any amount of water is enough? Or is it the reverse? That when the urine is there first, everybody agrees you need at least the revius, but if the water is there first, then there's a debate whether revius is required or it's sufficient to have a kosher. Okay. So then the Gemara says, Amar le Rav Yosef to Sham'e, Rav Yosef said to Hishamish, Aisi li reviasa demaya, Kirabi Zakai. Now this is really, really interesting. Rav Yosef says, I will engage in a little bit of a method that's more familiar to Talmudic academicians, but it's a question that we've shown and grapple with on occasion also. What did Rabbi Yosef say? What did Rabbi Yosef say? So some of you are going to look at me and think, I'm crazy. What am I asking? I can read what Rabbi Yosef said. Josh, if I asked you, what has Rabbi Yosef said? You'll look at me and say, I can read the line of the Gemara just like you can. Rabbi Yosef said to his shamash, I see the reviasa demaya to Rabbi Zakai. Bring me a revias of water like Rabbi Zakai. That is one possibility. That's not the way I read the Gemara, nor the way I think I want to read the Gemara. What did Rabbi Yosef actually say? Amar Rabbi Yosef l'shamay, Rabbi Yosef l'shamay, I say le reviasa demaya. Bring me a revias of water. Period. And the Gemara says, Kirabi Zakai. In other words, who's uttering those last two words? Is that the editors of the Sugya? Or is that Rabbi Yosef talking? Now I assume that's not part of Rabbi Yosef's words. I can't prove that, but I would assume, you know, if I were to ask my son to bring me something for some halachic reason, I wouldn't say, okay, you bring me that thing of water in accordance with Shita so-and-so. I would just ask him to bring me a cup of water. If he asked Abba, why'd you ask me to do that? I would say, oh, because we hold like Rabbi Zakai. So I assume, and I could be wrong, but I assume Rabbi Yosef only said, I see the Rabbi Yosef Demaya. Which begs the question, how does the Gemara know it's Rabbi Zakai? Maybe the urine was there already. Maybe the urine was there already, and maybe everybody agrees in that case let's say this was a case the urine was there already, and Rabbi Yosef is the one who says that everybody agrees if the urine is there already, you need a revius. So how can you tell from Rav Yosef's statement that he paskins like Rav Zakai? Remember, according to Rav Yosef, arguing Rav Nachman in the previous line, Rav Yosef said that if the urine is there already, everybody agrees you need a revius. It's that if the urine isn't there yet, if the urine isn't there yet, then it's a machlokas. So how does the Gemara know that Rabbi Yosef is talking about a context in which there's no urine there yet? And the answer is, I don't know, but I have to assume from the Gemara that when Rav Yosef said to Ashamish, bring me Rav Yosef, it's because Rav Yosef wanted to urinate, and therefore, he said, I need a Rav Yosef of water. Now, according to Rav Yosef, if the water is there first, it's a machlokas, whether or not you need a revius or a kosher. And the fact that the water is going to be there first, and Rav Yosef is saying, bring me a revius of mayim, indicates that Rav Yosef is postulating like Rav Zakkai. But that part is actually kind of missing from the Gemara. I didn't see anything was shown in common. You have to assume for Rav Yosef's statement, unless you assume, and I think it's not correct, that Rav Yosef says, I see the revius of the mayim to Rav Zakkai. You have to assume it was a case where the Meiraglayim, where the urine wasn't there yet. Rav Yosef wanted this. He needed this water so that the Meiraglayim would not become a problem. And that's why the Gemara could infer from that to Rabbi Zakkai. That's my assumption. Okay. Fine. So that's the way we paskin. We paskin like Rabbi Zakkai. We paskin like Rav Yosef's understanding. And I don't know if the Shulchan Aruch quotes it, but the Rambam says, Revius is only sufficient for, I think, urine of one shot. It's not that you can have any amount of urine and you can add a revius of mayim and it would be okay. Okay. Next, the Gemara says, Tana Rabbanan, Gerev Shil Rei. You have a, I don't know what the various chamber pot, bedpan, Va'avit Shil Mei Raglayim. The word Gerev is used for a vessel that is used to hold feces. And avit is used for something that's used to contain urine. So it's what's always called the Gerev Sharei and Avit Shomei Raglayim. Maybe they had a slightly different shape, but they're fundamentally the same thing. Also, Likros Priyashma Kenegdam, the Afal Pi Shein Bahem Klum. You're not allowed, even if you have a Gerev Sharei, you have this chamber pot, this or Avit Shomei Raglayim, that was empty, so there's nothing in it, you're not allowed to read Priyashma in its presence. The assumption is, it stinks, it has stuff absorbed, it's something that's filthy. The Rush and other Rishonim here have a discussion, so this apply, most Rishonim assume, even if you rinse them out. What the Rush and other Rishonim talk about is, what if the chamber pot was not made of pottery? Let's say it were made of metal, and some Rishonim say, what if it's made of glass? And in that case, I think the Rush says that it's permitted, once you clean it out, those are things that they can be cleaned out. But the earthenware, it's so absorptive, which is true, the earthenware absorbs so much that it doesn't matter that Gerev Sharei and Avit Shomei Raglayim under no circumstances will be considered clean. So here it's understood the Rush would say specifically earthenware, maybe wood as well, which is much more porous. Metal is easy to clean out. Okay. And then the Braisa continues. Umeiraglayim Asman, let's say there's no container holding them, but the Meiraglayim themselves, the urine itself, Achiyata Lasokhan Mayim, the Kamayata Lasokhan Mayim, Kol Shahu Rabzakai Omer Raviz. This part of the Braisa is the part that was the Braisa that was quoted before. In other words, the Braisa that we analyzed right before this, whether it was the debate of Nachman or Rav Yosef, when Raviz, when Kol Shahu, it was just a smaller part of this bigger Braisa, which is not done yet. And then the Braisa says, Bein lefrei hamita, bein la'achar hamita. If there is either the urine present or the Gerev Shorei or the Avit Shomei Raglayim, it makes no difference whether it's in front of the bed or behind the bed. Either way, it's prohibited. Now, what does this mean? So it means that I'm in a room, and in this room there is a bed. And then in this room, there's also one of these items. Let's just say the Gerev, just to keep it simple, it'll all be the same, a Gerev Shilrei. There's a chamber pot. So, I'm not allowed to daven in its presence. And the Braisa says, whether it's standing, let's say I'm standing here, and the bed is here, and the chamber pot's between us. That's one possibility. The other possibility is the bed is forming a kind of barrier between me and the chamber pot. It's L'achar Amita. So the first Tana in this Braisa says, that you cannot daven in the room if there's, let's say, a Gerev Sharei or any of these things. Fein lefnei hamita, fein la'achar hamita. Okay. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel omer, le'achar hamita kore, lefnei hamita eno kore, avamarcheku arba amos v'kore. So Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel makes a distinction between where this Gerev is, where the chamber pot is, behind, on the other side of the bed, or between me and the bed. If it's on the other side of the bed, you can read Kriya Shema. If it's between me and the bed, you can't read Avol Marchik Arba Amos Bekare. But you can move away for, or you have to move away for Amos and read. The Gemara is going to analyze what that means in a moment. But first, it's going to quote one more opinion. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar Omer, Afilu Bayis Mea Ama. Even if the house is huge, you're in this huge room, 100 Amos, it's 150 feet. Wide, long, whatever it is. That's pretty big. There aren't so many rooms that are like that. Even in a room that size, he says, you're not allowed to read Kriya Shema ad sheyotzi'ein o sheyanichein tachas amita. You either have to take them out of the room, or you have to put them under the bed. And somehow when they're under the bed, they're considered covered. The Gemara is going to talk about how tall a bed. What does it mean under the bed? That was Rav Zakkai's opinion. Okay, so now, the first thing the Gemara has to deal with is, what was that line of that Avol Marchik Kudal Ramos? So the Gemara asks, Ibaylahu, Heichi Ka'amar Rabban Shimon Ben Gamliel. What was Rabban Shimon Gamliel's position? He didn't remember. He distinguished between La'achar Amita and La'fe Amita, whether it's between you and the bed or on the other side of the bed. And then he said something about Avol Marchik Kudal Ramos. So the Gemara says, there are two ways to read this. Possibility one is Achar Hamita Kore Miyat. If the chamber pot is on the other side of the bed, you can read standing right next to the bed. Read Kriya Shema. However, I lost my place one second. And Lefnei Hamita, if it's between you and the bed, then you have to be Marfik Alba Arba Omos Kore. In other words, does Rabbi Shimon Leo believe that you can read Kriya Shema even if the chamber pot is between you and the bed, as long as you're 4 amos away from it? O Dilma no hachi kamar. Maybe Rabbi Shimon ben Leil is much more stringent. La'achar amitra, you can read Kriya Shema, but provided that marchik dalet amos v'kore. If the chamber pot is on the other side of the bed, then as long as it's on the other side of the bed and you're 4 amos away, you're good. Avol. But lefnei amita ain't a korikla. If it's between you and the bed, no matter how far away from you, you're not allowed to read Kriya Shema. So which way does Rabban Shimon Gamliel go? So the Gemara says Toshma. Now, just to give you a heads up so it's easy to read the Braisa, this is a Braisa that's going to quote the two opinions that we just read of Rabban Shimon Gamliel and Rabban Shimon ben Elazar, but they're going to be reversed. Now, it's irrelevant that they're reversed. The Gemara is going to say, okay, flip it around. But based upon the presentation of what was Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's opinion in the first Braisa, what will be listed as Rabbi Shimon Elazar, he clarifies more than the first Braisa. So the Braisa says the following, Toshma, Tanya, Rabbi Shimon Elazar Omer, Achar Hamita Kore Miyad, Lefnei Hamita Machet Arba Amos. It's very clear that if a chamber pot is on the other side of the bed, you can be on one side of the bed and reading Kriya Shema. And then when it says Lefnei Hamita Machet Arba Amos, it means the chamber pot's on the same side of the bed, Arba Amos is enough. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer Afilu Bayis Mea Ama Lo Yikra Ad Sheyotzi'eim O Ad Sheyanicheim Tachas Hamita. So that here, Rashbag's opinion, Rav Shimon Le's opinion, is what was Rav Shimon Le's opinion in the first Braisa. So now the Gemara just says, okay, very nice. Va'ayan is Shitamon. Our question you have solved, right? We know what Rabban Shimon Le's opinion is in the first Braisa. He's lenient in both directions. However, Masi Yosef Kashen Azadi. The two braises contradict one another. The positions are flipped. So the Gemara, as it's classical fast and fast, is epoch, and it says bus raisa. Flip around the second braisa. Say that Rabbi Shimon Elazar's opinion, the second braisa, is you're not allowed to read Kriya Shema no matter how big the house is, unless you take it out and put it under the bed. So now the Gemara just asks, my chos is to apchis bus raisa, epoch kamaisa. Why did you choose to flip the second one around? Flip the first one around. Instead of switching B to A, switch A to B. What's the difference? So which of course, as you well understand, had the Gemara said, okay, let's flip the first one around, they would have asked the same question. Why do you flip the first one around? Flip the second one around. Fair question. So the Gemara says, I'll tell you what. Man Shamis lay the Amar Kule Bayis Karba Masami Rabbi Shimon Ben Elazar. Who is the Tana that we know holds that no matter how big a house is, we treat it like it's only four amos big. That's Rav Shimon ben Elazar. Okay, so I ask you, Rabosai, a question. How do we know that? What did Rav Shimon ben Elazar say? If you don't know the answer to this question, I would encourage you not to feel bad at all. Because Rashi, writing here, says, Man Shamisle, he just writes, Lo Yadati Hechani. Rashi says, I have no idea where. And I think it's reasonable to say that if Rashi doesn't have the Bekias to know where this is, none of us are necessarily expected to do so. If you want a little fun, it just shows you the inordinate Bekias of Rav Kiva Eger. If you look in the Gilyan Hashas on the left side of the page, you will see there is one short Gilyan Hashas, and then it's a very, very long Gilyan Hashas. And Rabbi Kiva Eger is listing all the places in Shas where Rashi says, I don't know. So that's a very long list, but I have to say, for 2,700 blot, it's a pretty short list. Okay, so anyway, some of the Rishonim find a source in Eiruvin. In the context of Eiruvin, I'll just explain the concept there. If a person goes outside the tchum, for example, I accidentally go outside the tchum. I didn't realize it. I went outside the 2,000 cubits, which is my limit to Shabbos. And I say, Oive, what do I do now? And the answer is, I'm stuck. I'm not allowed to move around more than Dalet Amos. So we spoke about this recently, about Behuva and Tzon. Like, how do you figure out the Dalet Amos, which direction, and so on. Okay. Now, let's say I went outside the tchum, but in the context of doing so, I stepped into KJ. I stepped into the shul. Okay, and I'm already well outside the tchum. However, I'm inside an enclosed building. So the halacha is that all of KJ is Kedalet Amos Bami. The entire building, the entire bias is like Dalet Amos to Dalet Amos. I can walk around from the first floor to the second floor to the eighth floor to the sanctuary to the chapel in the basement. I can walk anywhere in the building if I stay inside because the entire bias is treated like Dalet Amos to Dalet Amos. So that's where some of the Bishonim find somewhere in the second parak in Eiruvin. I think Rabbeinu Yonah tries to find something there where it is that Rav Shimon ben Elazar is the one who holds that the entire bias is treated like Dalet Amos. Isaac, you had a question?
Isn't there a Rav Meir somewhere in Brachas, I came across it many years ago, that regarding Netilat Yadayim in the morning, that you can do Netilat Yadayim, it doesn't have to be right when you get up, because your house is considered your Dalet Amos, your Rishus.
I'm not familiar with that. I'm not familiar with that in the Gemara. I know that's an issue that is raised, let's say, in Shulchan Aruch from Poskim. How do you treat that? But I'm not aware of it being, certainly we haven't seen it yet in the Gemara. I don't recall it anywhere. The fact that I don't recall it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just means I don't know about it. But I'm not familiar.
And another question. So according to Rav Shimon ben Elazar, if the Gerach Shorei, the Ovet Shomei Raglayim, if it was filled with urine, but you move it under the bed and it's totally covered, would it be permissible to do Kriya Shema?
It'd be the same then. A Gerach Shorei, I think the point is the Gerach Shorei, it makes no difference whether it has stuff in it or doesn't have stuff in it. And the only difference will be it might smell bad. The assumption of all of this that we've shown and point out is it can't have a bad smell. Mm-hmm. Right? It has to be that it doesn't smell. But a Gerach Shorei itself, because that's what the thing is, even if you cover it and there's no smell, it is considered a davar hametunach.
Even though it's covered, it's under the bed.
No. If you see the Gerach, if the whole thing is covered, that's different.
Yeah, but if you move it under the bed.
So we're going to talk about now, the Gemara Shlomo, what it means under the bed. Under the bed is considered covered. Okay? No. Behind the bed is considered, and not if you hold like from Shimon Lazar, but if you hold like from Shimon Leo, behind the bed is considered another makom. So that's okay also. Again, provided that you're not smelling. So now the Gemara says the following, and there's going to be a big dispute as to how to read this. Amar Rav Yosef, five lines before the lines get really wide in our Gemara. Amar Rav Yosef, Va'ay minei me Rav Huna, I asked a question from Rav Huna. He presented this topic, how do you deal with the bed? So he said the following, Mita pachos mishlosha, this is Rashi's gear so that we have, Pshitali b'chelavud dami. If the bed, under the bed, they didn't, you know, their beds were not really like our beds. There is under our beds. Most of the beds I've ever encountered have a box spring and have a mattress on top. There's very little space under the bed. You probably never get three tachim. But imagine something more like, I don't know, a camp bed where there's no box spring. It's just like a metal frame with metal wires across and they stick a mattress on top. So you could have a significant amount of space under the bed. So Rav Yosef said, I asked Rav Huna, what is the story with the size of this bet? So the way Rashi explains, if you put stuff under the bed, does the bed constitute a cover, covering up the Derek Shorei, let's say, this chamber pot? So of course, if it's less than 3 tefachim high, the bed, for sure, because 3 tefachim, you say love it, it's like a solid bed all the way to the ground. Arba, hamisha, shisha, shiva, shmona, tisha, mahu. What about 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9? What about in that case? Now, why would you think it's, not a problem? So you'll see from the next line. So Amar Lei, presume Rav Huna responded to Rav Yosef, Mayadana, I don't know what the din is. Then the Gemara says, Asara vada in lomi boili. Rav Yosef says, I definitely don't have to ask if the bed is 10 tefachim tall. Not necessary. Why? So Amar Baye, Shaper Abdis, the loy bailach. It's good that you didn't ask, but there was no reason to ask. Kal Asara Rashusa Acharisihi. And once you have 10 tefachim under the bed, so it's not like you can say that this bed constitutes a separate place, the bed and it's underneath. There's the bed, and then there's a whole space under the bed, and that's right next to you with no barrier. And therefore, once you have 10 tefachim of height, for sure, putting the Gerif Shorei under the bed does not help you. Less than 3 tefachim, for sure it's good. 10 tefachim or more, for sure it's no good, it's another rishos. It's between 3, anything, 3 or more, up until, but not including 10, is the question, and the Gemara doesn't answer the question. That is the way Rashi explained this particular Gemara. Now, the Rosh and Rabbeinu Yonah quote a different interpretation from the Gaon. I don't remember which Gaon is, or Haigon, perhaps, who says that the Gemara's question is totally different. It's not asking about under the bed. It's asking about what is considered l'achar hamita, the other side of the bed. So, and here, everything is the exact opposite. If the top of the bed is less than 3 tefachim, not the airspace under the bed, if the top of the bed is less than 3 tefachim off the ground, it's like there's no bed there. It's just like a bump in the ground. If the bed, the top of the bed is 10 tefachim tall, then the bed, even if it's, I don't know if it's open underneath or not, maybe it's not, is like a mechitza. So it separates between you and the other side of the bed, and it would be fine. And the question is, between 4 and 9, is that considered sufficient for our purposes to be considered le'achar hamita or not? Okay. And the Gemara's answer is, well, we don't really have an answer. If the Gemara continues, Amar Rava, the last medium width line in the Gemara, Hilchos apachos mishlosha kelav adami, asara reshusa harisahi, mishlosha arasara, hainu d'va'oi minei Rav Yosef b'Rav Huna v'lo pashaflei. So Rava basically accepts everything Rav Yosef said. 3 or less than 3, is kalavah, whatever that means. That's the machlokas Rashi in the Gaon. 10 or more is a different rishus. And between 4 and 9 is a question. So what's the halacha? So we're machmir between 4 and 9. Now, this would all be very, very nice, except for one little problem. It's not really a problem in the Gemara, is that the Rif, and I believe the Rambam, omit any discussion of the size of the bed. They omit it totally. And the question is why. And there are two answers that are proposed, I think, in the Rush. One answer, which I don't like, but is probably the better answer, although it leaves really a gap, is that it's obvious what the answer is. We know what the din is by 3. We know what the din is by 10. And somehow we assume that even less than 10 is most definitely not considered a barrier. Less than 10 is not considered a barrior. It's very difficult. It's difficult, but it's less difficult than I'll say the next approach. But it's basically to say the Rambam and the Rav omitted it because the din was obvious. They didn't need to tell you that. Everybody knows that 10 is another reshus and less than 3 is a lover. Yeah, but you should at least say that 4 to 9, we're not sure, is a suffix and you have to go to Chumrah. So there's really a lot missing there. The alternative approach, which I think can be very unsatisfying, is that the reason why the Rambam and the Rif do not quote it is because this whole question is only being discussed, let's say, within Rav Shimon ben Elazar, if you want to know if it's underneath the bed. He's the only one who said, or even Rav Shimon Leah might agree, that you put it under the bed. The Tanna Kamma said that you're not allowed to daven. The opening opinion was, you're not allowed to read Bein Lefnei Amita, Bein La'achar Amita. Comes along Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and he says, no, Lefnei Amita, you need to move away 4 amos. La'achar Amita is okay. And Rabbi Shimon Elazar says, no, Lefnei Amita, La'achar Amita are no good, but under the Amita is good. So the Rush suggests maybe the Rif Paskins like the Tanna Kamma. The Tanna Kamma makes no distinctions and no dispensations. Can't have it in the house. So the truth is, that's very, very difficult because the Gemara is going to explicitly pass in light Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel. We're going to read it in the next line. And even if you read like Rashi did, that we're talking about putting it under the bed, and Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel did not mention putting it under the bed, so maybe he just doesn't hold of that. Why not? He permits it, even if it's Lefnei Hamita, as long as you leave Dalet Amos. Why would he be more stringent than Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar? So it's very, very hard to understand why this halacha is omitted by the major poskim, and I believe it doesn't appear in the Shulchan Aruch either. The Mechaber following the Rambam, they just don't talk about what size of the bed or underneath the bed. Don't know. Now, how do we poskim? So the Gemara says, Amar Rav, at the end of the first wide line in the Gemara, halacha k'Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. We poskim that way. Like Shimon Elazar, v'chein Amar Baali, Amar of Yachov, Baali is the name of a person. Barad Bashmuel halacha k'Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. He quoted the name of Yaakov, the son of Shmuel's daughter, but halacha is like Shimon Elazar. Why was Rav Yaakov's father? Why is he not quoted by his father's name? It's not just that when we call people up today, let's say to the Torah, we call them up by a father's name. Typically, when we write in the Ksuba, tradition is to write with the father's name. So, and in the Gemara, certainly, whenever they quote Amorayim, they don't quote the mother, they quote the father. So why is he the son of Bashmua? The answer is, I don't think you should point that here, but elsewhere, Tosus likes to note, Shmuel's daughter was taken into captivity, and she was, I guess, raped, but her rape, I'm not sure if it was raped or not, but her captor eventually converted and married her. But Rabbi Yaakov, I think his name was Kiura, Isur Giura. Isur the Ger, I think was his name. But because Rabbi Yaakov was conceived when his father wasn't Jewish, he is not technically related to his father, and therefore he is called by his mother's name. Of course, his mother doesn't really have a name either. His mother's name is Shmuel's daughter. Unless you think that this is a relic of the past, you can actually go today to certain communities in Brooklyn, and you will say, I kid you not when I say this, you will find announcements, Mazel Tov to so-and-so on the engagement of his daughter to so-and-so. And his daughter does not have a name. So that is not, that practice of what we call Hadarat Nashim is not practiced in our community. I think that's for the better. Anyway, in this case, we don't know Shmuel's daughter's name either. She's just Bas Shmuel. And therefore, Rabbi Yaakov is Rabbi Yaakov Berei the Bas Shmuel because he wasn't actually his father's son, halachically speaking. So they both said the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. V'Rava Amar ain halacha k'Rabbi Shimon Elazar. Rava says halacha is not like Rabbi Shimon Elazar, which is kind of interesting because he doesn't say whether the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel or the halacha is like the Tanna Kamma. So you're going to say the Paskins like maybe the Rambam and the Rif Paskin like the Tanna Kamma. They don't have any of these kulos. I don't think that's the way it actually appears in Shulchan Aruch it might appear that way. That's what you have to say, but it's still a little bit difficult, I think. I would have said, if you had asked me, by the way, that there aren't three opinions in this Braisa. There are only two opinions in the Braisa. The opening line of the Braisa is, you're not allowed to read Bein Lefnei Amita, Bein La'achar Amita. Colon. Now, what does this mean? And there are two opinions as to what that means. The first opinion is Rashbag, and the second one is Rashbar, Shimon Elazar. That's what I would have said. the claim that there's three opinions here is kind of interesting because the Gemara never really explicitly acknowledges a first opinion. I would have thought it's Rav Shimon Elazar, Rav Shimon Leo. And when Rava says we don't pass Rav Shimon Elazar, it's because we're passing Rav Shimon Leo, not like a putative third opinion, that a separate opinion of the Tanakhama. Okay. So anyway, so that's where the Gemara leaves this. We have only two topics left. We're not, I'll just let you know coming attractions, God willing, next week. We have two topics left. The next one is exceedingly, extremely halacha lemaisa. I'll have to be very well prepared for next week. It has to do with reading, doing things, actually in this case specifically, engaging in sexual intercourse in a room in which there are sarim or tefillin. Sefer Torah is not as common as tefillin. Tefillin could certainly be more of an issue. We'll have to talk about what happened to the poor mezuzah here. And that's going to be discussed and what kind of cover is necessary. That's particularly relevant today. At the very least, you have to discuss what is the status of printed sfarim. Because if you have a guest room in which there are sfarim and you are inviting guests over, that is potentially a real issue. So that's why tefillin could be an issue as well, but it's not so hard to move, not have tefillin in that room. It's a much bigger problem unless the guest brought his tefillin with him, in which case it could be a problem as well. So that's why this, of all the things that we discussed, this might be the most halacha lemaisa thing in the entire sugya. So we're going to talk about that. And then we're actually going to talk about, for the moment, status of contemporary bathrooms and the Beisak Kisei Shel Parsai. Those are the last two topics left in our sugya. And I know I've been saying for weeks, we're almost done. But we will be done after those two topics. And after a very short Mishnah, we'll be on to something that, a new parak, something that I think some of you might have learned maybe when you were in Yeshiva Katana, the famous parak of Tfilas HaShachar, a little more ethereal and a little less mundane than the topics, as important as they are, than we've been dealing with until now. Any questions? Okay.